client presentations. The case will be taken under advisement. The next case of the morning is numbers 034023 and 041375. Richard Herman et al. Against Central States Southeastern and Southwestern Areas Pension Fund. Ms. Thompson.
Good morning, Your Honors. May it please the Court, I'm Ann Curry Thompson from Detroit, Michigan. I'm here today representing the plaintiffs in this case. The plaintiffs in this case are appealing a grant by the district court below of summary judgment on, I would have to say, their critical claims. And those are twofold. One, plaintiffs challenged a series of amendments to the prohibited reemployment rule, claiming that they violated the anti-cutback rule as interpreted by Hines and as affirmed by the Supreme Court. Secondly, that their benefit determinations in regard to the individuals who were assessed various paybacks of money, pension benefits that they had received while the fund worked in employment that they deemed to be prohibited and in violation of their rule, that these decisions were in the context of the entire case with respect to each individual, arbitrary and capricious.
Just as a point of clarification, yes, on that second thing, I take it you're asking us specifically to look at Mr. Paul, Mr. Helvey, Mr. Rose, and Mr. Arwood. Is that correct?
That is correct, Your Honor. Of the individuals who brought the case,
everybody else, for whatever reason that we're not worried about.
These are the individuals who have a continued monetary interest in pursuing this case to this level and who are still able to represent the other plaintiffs in regard to the equitable claims that they brought about the anti-cutback rule. So the issues are still before the court.
Well, right. I mean, but that the other has more to do with the equitable side. But just in terms of the individual benefit claims, it's these four people.
That is correct, Your Honor.
And you concede that it's the arbitrary and capricious standard of review that applies here.
With respect to their individual benefit determinations,
plan, yeah.
Yes, Your Honor.
Okay. Go ahead.
All right. I would also note for the court that a favorable ruling on behalf of the plaintiffs with respect to the anti-cutback rule would, of course, you know, float all boats, including would be, I believe, dispositive of the individual benefit claims as well. However, I do believe that even in that scenario, the individual benefit claims raise certain issues that are important with respect to plan administration and how fiduciaries should, in fact, administer various restrictive rules under the terms of the plan.
It's hard for me to see how this fits in the anti-cutback rubric, to be honest, because what you seem to be complaining about right now is a move by the plan that I would suppose makes it somewhat easier for them to collect improperly paid benefits, but it doesn't have anything to do with the eligibility for benefits, with conditions, with anything. It's a purely procedural move on this part, and it has the air of saying, under the old system where separate lawsuits had to be filed, it was administratively complex for the plan to collect these kinds of benefits, and now it's going to be easier. But that's like saying, you know, it used to be easier to have a windfall. I mean, I'm putting to one side the fact that maybe some of these were or were not correctly regarded as impermissible benefits, but if you'll stipulate that in some cases people get paid, you know, people go out and take work that they shouldn't take, that does happen sometimes, then the plan has every right and always has had every right to suspend these early benefits.
That is the question, Your Honor, whether or not they always did have the right to do that under the terms of the plan.
Well, but surely they did. I guess let me start with the basics. The participants in the plan from all time periods relevant here had no right to collect benefits if they were engaged in prohibited employment.
Not for simultaneous performance. That is correct, Your Honor.
Well, they didn't, you know, for months A to B, you know, they did not have the right to double dip. There were definitions of prohibited employment. They couldn't do it. And they had no right to collect the benefits. And the plan had the right to get any benefits paid by mistake, namely paid not in accordance with the plan. And so your only focus is on the fact that how does the plan go about getting its money back? Does it have to file a separate lawsuit, which means that you have to pay the judgment in some current time period, or do they get to deduct, you know, this 100% for 3 months and 25, which is recognized in the regulations?
In order to answer or to speak to the questions that are implied in what you just said, I need to back up a bit to explain to the court what the situation was before the amendments vis-a-vis what the situation was after, and to bring into that analysis the rationale of this court in the Hines decision.
With the Supreme Court's Hines case, I mean, you're very nice to talk about our Hines decision, but we've been superseded, and it's the Supreme Court we need to look at.
Well, that is correct, Your Honor, but it's not been superseded in any meaningful respect. I think the Supreme Court's decision affirming Hines basically adopted its rationale. It is a much shorter opinion, but it applies the same very common sense analysis from the point of view of a reasonable participant of whether or not there has been a change affecting their receipt of an accrued benefit.
Well, you're defining this very broadly, because what Hines is about is what I'm calling, you know, substantive eligibility decisions, just as this plan amendment for a little while had something like that too, of course, because it expanded the area of prohibited employment, and they repealed that, so I take it we're not worried about that part anymore.
That is correct.
Right.
Your Honor, I still have to talk a bit about the Hines decision, because I do believe it was affirmed in this respect by the Supreme Court, and is this. It is true that the specific issue in Hines dealt with a change in, it was an amendment expanding the scope of what prohibited reemployment
right.
was. But if Hines established one thing, it is this, that the anti-cutback rule, in essence, is broader than the anti-forfeiture provisions of of ERISA. In other words, the question, and I believe Hines says this specifically, is not whether an accrued benefit has been changed or eliminated or reduced. The question is whether or not there has been an amendment affecting a condition of receipt of those accrued benefits, or whether or not there has been an amendment that further burdens the receipt of those accrued benefits. And if so, then it has the effect of reducing an accrued benefit. When a benefit is suspended, even though the monetary amount of the benefit is not changed, and even though the participant is in some sense still eligible for that benefit, because of the restrictive plan amendment, can no longer receive that benefit under certain circumstances, then there has been a change. So the first question is,
well, why do you say that, though? I mean, if the person got a bill every month after erroneous receipt of benefits saying, please write us a check for $1,000 so that you can pay back the benefits we shouldn't have given you because you were in prohibited employment, they would still be getting their check for $3,000, and they'd have to write another check back to the plan for the $1,000. You don't dispute that the plan can recoup erroneously paid benefits, do you?
The plan can do so under
and
the
always
old
has
rule
been able to do so
under certain circumstances only.
You want them to have to file a lawsuit, and I'm saying, why can't they just send a bill, in effect?
They could do that, Your Honor.
And so all they're doing is netting it out, saying, why should we send you a check for $3,000 and get $1,000 back? Or, you know, actually, I'm just using exemplary numbers, it would be 25% after the first 3 months. But
this goes, Your Honor, to the to the question of whether or not the court will accept or rely upon the fund's policy arguments for doing what it did in this case.
And why do we have to go to policy argument? Why aren't we first construing just what does the cut? What does Hines mean, and what does the cutback provision mean when it talks about these changes? Because I understand you're taking a pragmatic point of view that when the plan can engage in this kind of self-help measure, it makes, at a very practical level, it makes the recipients worse off because now the recoupment is going to happen very quickly. And I also, if I'm not mistaken, believe that you're arguing that there is a flaw in the way the plan actually implements its decisions about what's prohibited employment, in that it's not being clear about what's prohibited and so on. But I'm trying to put that to one side for right now.
But the first question that I think you have to ask is the benefit being affected or burdened, one that is attributable to past service? And then Hines asked that question, and if it's yes, then you go on to the next question. And the next question is there a change such that that benefit is harder to receive under certain circumstances? And if so, then that amendment or change violates the rule. Now, the fund's argument here, as I understand it, is not that the rationale of Hines would not apply here so much as it is that there has been no change. And if there's one thing that is absolutely clear, is that the plan had no provision before the March 02 amendments to offset future pension benefits by the amount of the claimed overpayment. And that this was put in, their ability to do that was put in by a plan amendment, which they could have had before had they wanted it, but had not put in.
But that particular part of it didn't change the kind of job you could have, didn't change how many years you needed to have worked, didn't change a lot of the kinds of things that were issue in Hines.
It did not change, literally, did not change an accrued benefit per se. It further burdened the receipt of that accrued benefit. Now, ultimately,
the benefits that, by hypothesis, you didn't have a right to get. I mean, there's a windfall period of time when you got benefits when you were in prohibited employment, and now a recoupment period of time.
Windfall, Your Honor, is always a possibility, and that is why a plan can provide, in as a matter of plan design, a mechanism that speaks to that. But there is a difference between what a plan can provide as a matter of initial plan design and what they can amend thereafter.
Let me ask you this. Suppose, I have the feeling that there may be, let's say, a very tight linkage between your arguments about the way the plan figures out what's prohibited employment and this recoupment argument that you're making. Because if, contrary to what seems to be the case, the plan always had, you know, a written submission from the employee or from the participant, and it always sent a letter out saying, you propose to be, you know, a building maintenance person, and we hereby decree that this is permissible under the terms of the plan. If you always had that, then the odds that there would be one of these mistakes presumably would be much lower. Procedures oftentimes help catch these kinds of things, and I gather, at least with the case of Mr. Rose, that that's one of your arguments, that he, in fact, did get that kind of certainty from the plan, and then they went back and said, just kidding, you know, we actually think you're in prohibited employment. They tried to recoup. Well, that the real problem there is the underlying determination, and I'm just wondering if one were to fix the procedures for the underlying determinations, how much is left of this windfall argument of yours?
Well, I think it would be very important to fix that, not just for these plaintiffs, but for everybody to come hereafter. And I do think that participants have a right to expect of their trustees, that they will have guidelines, that they will apply their decisions, their principles and plan terms consistently from one plaintiff to another participant in that context.
Sure.
And I think that these four plaintiffs illustrate very graphically how under the administration of the old rule that did not happen. And I think it illustrates something else, that the purpose of the rule has changed. When people go out to work as retirees and they're retired Teamsters, they have a certain, most of them know there is such a rule in some sense, and they believe that if they're not out there doing non-union trucking work or something that is obviously forbidden by the rule, then they're okay. And there is nothing in the plan itself or any guidelines that are published or even any publicity that is put out by the fund which ever advised them differently until more recent years. And it's being learned case by case by case by case how they are, in fact, interpreting this rule. But it's because the purpose of the rule itself has changed. And that is, it is no longer something, a rule to prevent participants from undercutting union jobs after they retire. It is to save the fund money. It is a way to fix the financial problems in the fund by taking it out of the retirees. But that's not really what's important here. And Mr. Nelson was very candid. It's not so much, what's important is recouping money from the retirees, although that's a financial benefit, to be sure. It is the deterrent effect against working participants from retiring on these early enhanced retirement benefits because they're very young, they know they're not going to be able to sit around on their hands, and they're going to supplement their income. So, yes. I mean, there's a whole lot of changes here, and I do believe, as the court says, there is a very tight linkage. And ultimately, it is up for this court. Oh, I'm in my rebuttal time. Ultimately, it is up for this court to determine the reach of Hines. However, I have read it again and again and again, and I believe that if you read Hines the way it is written, that it would apply in this case.
Thank you, Ms. Thompson. We'll hear now from Mr. Franzik.
Good morning, Your Honors. May it please the Court, my name is John Franzik, and I represent the Appellees Cross Appellants Central States Pension Fund and its trustees in this matter. I want to begin by addressing the topic that took up a lot of the appellant's argument time, which was the issue concerning whether or not this offset issue would constitute a cutback, and we would argue that it clearly does not. There is no dispute that that in a situation where the plan is offsetting or recouping funds, that these are funds to which the participant never had a right.
Well, I mean, there is a dispute about that in a different sense, but I think I at least am prepared to believe that there is a set of cases exactly as you describe, where the participant never had a right to the funds, and the only issue is the procedure by which the plan gets itself paid back. I mean, it may not be every case, and I'm very worried about the seeming arbitrariness of the way the plan figures out who's in that set of retirees. But there are some, and so then the question as for the cutback issue is whether the plan can choose this offset way or whether the plan has to send people bills every month or whether the plan has to go file lawsuits or whatever.
Yes. Well, there's two distinct issues there. One is whether, assuming that the underlying determination is correct, whether the plan's right to offset constitutes a cutback. And then there's the second question of whether the individual benefit determination itself was correct or was arbitrary and capricious. Obviously, if the underlying determination is arbitrary and capricious, you never need to reach the offset question because the plan was not entitled to offset because the underlying determination was wrong to begin with.
You don't in the broad sense, but I think one of the things the plaintiffs are worried about is if, suppose the following hypothetical scenario. The trustees of the plan and their various administrators are sitting around and they suddenly decide one day that for somebody who used to drive a truck running your own you know, garden service is prohibited employment, and let's just assume that's not covered under any Teamsters contract anywhere relevant. So they just start deducting from people's paychecks who have somehow notified them that this is the kind of employment they have. No reason to have believed in the past, and now, I mean, this is serious money for people. You know, they rely on that $3,000 or $2,000 a month or whatever it is, and all of a sudden they not only have no check that's coming in there, but they don't even have the supplemental employment. I mean, it's a terrible consequence. And if the plan can just, you know, somebody sits around musing one day and decides this isn't covered employment, there's a shift in the burden from the plan to the retiree.
Well, Your Honor, first of all, I would point out that under the terms of the plan, any participant has the right to submit any particular job to the plan for determination ahead of even taking the job.
And then look what happened to Mr. Rose. He did exactly that. The plan tells him not once but twice that he is permitted to have this work, and then it all of a sudden changes its mind and not only does so prospectively but tries to recoup retrospectively. What else is he supposed to do?
Well, Your Honor, the problem was when he originally gave the description of his job, he then later changed the description.
Not necessarily. He gave a general description of the job, and he furnished the name of his employer. So if the fund thought it needed more information, he was not holding anything back. They could have gone over there and interviewed the employer, watched him work all day. They could have done anything. It seems to me he was perfectly forthcoming, and he was told this is okay.
Well, Your Honor, I mean, first of all, it's not administratively feasible to conduct, I guess, a field investigation with respect to each participant short of cutting everybody's future benefits to nothing so we can pay to do the investigation.
But you could pick up the phone, or at a minimum, when you learn the additional information after you've already authorized employment, you could make a decision prospective.
The trustees could do that, and in some cases they do that, and there is a mechanism in the plan for participants to challenge, even if the underlying determination is correct, to challenge and make arguments concerning whether or not the so-called overpayment should be recouped or not. In this case, the trustees determined that it should not be because the trustees felt that the information that he originally gave was a misrepresentation of what the actual position was. But going back,
I'm not sure about, I mean, the administrative record suggests that he did tell them exactly what he was doing. I'm not sure whether their decision passes the arbitrary and capricious standard there.
Your Honor, what he originally stated he was doing was building maintenance.
He said building maintenance, and he also gave Trusco's address if somebody wanted to pick up the phone and ask. So he tells them that in 2001. There's another inquiry in 2002 where he calls it plant maintenance. Then they conduct a review. But he did argue to the fund that on November 17, 2000, building maintenance in this particular area didn't fall within the category. I mean, he puts it on the table for them. If they pay no attention to it, I guess there's very, very little he can do about that.
Well, building maintenance is typically a job where you're essentially custodial. You're taking care of jobs within a regular building. Plant maintenance is different. You're actually working in like a manufacturing type setting, and you may be repairing heavy machinery or doing things like that. That type of job is more what, you know, Teamsters may do, whereas the job of being a custodian generally would not be covered. So it, you know,
and there was also an SMSA problem here because the plan seems to have thought what made a difference was where the union office was as opposed to where the employer was.
Well, the issue here was that Mr. Rose did not fall within any specific area, so the fund had to interpret whether he was in the same area as the job, and he was within, you know, 10 miles of an actual employer that covers plant maintenance.
But not in the same SMSA, as it happens.
Well, it depends how you define SMSA.
Well, there's a very well understood definition of that for census purposes and for all others.
Well, there's a definition of it within that, but that the plan does not, on its face, incorporate that definition, and it and the SMSA determinations don't give you an answer. You know, they'll say the SMSA determinations will say Chicago metropolitan area, for example. You know, here's what it is, but if you're in a very rural area, there isn't an SMSA. But the trustees have not interpreted the plan to mean that, well, then it's okay if you take a job in a job classification and across the street there's a Teamster operation doing the exact same work that, well, because you're in a rural area, you get a pass, whereas if you're in a metropolitan area in Chicago, for example, the metropolitan area could stretch 50 or 100 miles. He was well within much shorter distance than that in this particular case. As one point I wanted to make going back to the offset before I move on to the appellant's other arguments is that the summary plan descriptions issued with respect to all of the benefit plans under the old plan always pretty clearly told the participants that they could be subject to an offset. The summary plan description said, and I quote, "Your future benefits may be reduced to reimburse the plan for any benefits improperly paid to you while you worked in prohibited reemployment." There's no way to read that. It's saying your future benefits will be reduced. That is the definition of an offset. And that was always in the summary plan description. And the summary plan description is usually the document which the participants read. And here it's consistent. The plan itself doesn't use the magic word offset, but it clearly gives that impression, or at least the trustees could reasonably interpret the plan as encompassing an offset. And what the appellant's argument here really amounts to is that under the old plan, they arguably had a license to steal, is what their argument is that we could, you know, these people never had a right to get these payments in the first place, but haha, because you didn't use the magic word offset, they can keep it and you can go sue everybody to get the money back, which would, of course, increase the administrative cost of funding, and indeed be worse for the... I wonder if the participants would really want that, where they have to pay a bunch of attorney's fees and litigate every single case of a repayment. It just doesn't make sense. It's not a sensible construction of the old plan.
That's why I wanted to kind of get back to this triggering point, because, you know, it sounds like the plan is taking the position that it can just decide on the basis of no evidence, some evidence, anything, that someone has gone into prohibited employment. Since you don't have any procedures in place that are particularly reliable to assess what that employment is or to find out exactly what the person is doing. And that's really what troubles me, because if somebody all of a sudden, suppose the plan makes a mistake. I mean, the plan's probably no more immune from mistakes than any other human institution I can think of. And so some poor guy all of a sudden isn't getting for 3 months his full early retirement pension because the plan just blew it, you know, and is deducting it, and he's supposed to, you know, pay his mortgage and live. And then the plan says, you know, 6 months later, oh, we're sorry, you know, we realize that you didn't do anything wrong after all. I mean, that's a very unsatisfactory picture.
That representation of how the process works, it doesn't have the full story. Under the terms of both the old plan and as the plan is existed now, there is a specific provision in the plan which says when you go back to work, when you're retired and drawing a pension, you go back to work, you're required to notify the pension plan up front that you've done so. That's required in the plan. If the participant chooses to violate the plan and not give notice, it's hard for the participant to come back after the fund discovers by, for instance, asking the Social Security Administration for wage earning records for the people. And we say, well, wait a minute, it looks like you've been working for 2 years. You never told us. It's really hard for them to complain that, well, you shouldn't be able to go back or cut this off now. If they follow the plan and tell you up front that they're doing the job, the problem largely goes away. And I would also point out that, as the record indicates, the plan now is sending out detailed questionnaires to many individuals. you know, as soon as they find out about that the person's going in and getting that information. So it's.
But telling the plan doesn't. I mean, some of these people did tell the plan. And I guess there's, you know, the question oral versus written, but plainly, as the example you were just talking about, building versus plant maintenance, when those might not, in an employer's lexicon, be the kind of very precise term of art that you're making it, if the plan flips and flops about whether something is or is not prohibited employment, that can still have very important effects on a person.
Well, there's no doubt that it would have an effect on the person because they're going to be losing some of the pension benefit.
Well, and having no money for a few months. I mean, let's be serious here. During the 100%, the 3-month 100% cutoff period.
That's true, Your Honor, but if the plan is followed and the notification's given up front and the information that's provided is complete and truthful, the incidence of that type of thing should be rather infinitesimal, we would all hope. And it's not argue.
Who has the burden of clarification? If somebody says building maintenance, who has the job of making sure it doesn't involve fixing machinery or some of the other things that might arguably be better described as plant maintenance? I mean, I'm a layperson, and those words don't convey to me such a precise difference. Now, I'm prepared to believe they do to the trustees of the plan, but it's when these broad titles can be used that may have some component of formerly covered work and some component not, who has the burden of clarifying? Maybe the person thinks they have told the plan everything they need to know.
Well, the phrase building maintenance has a specific meaning to the fund, and it has a meaning in the industry, and it's different than plant maintenance. And they're probably not going to say, well, does the person mean X when they say Y? So
suppose they say I'm a handyman.
Probably there would be an additional inquiry on that one, because I'm not sure that the term handyman conveys a specific job. I mean, there are always going to be some situations which fall into the gray area, and that's why they can ask ahead of taking the job whether it will be approved or not. And if they disagree with the initial determination, they can go through the appeals process and take it to the Board of Trustees. So there's a way to avoid the risk that going forward, later on, there's going to be a problem. Moving on to the cross appeal, unless there's any more questions regarding the main appeal, the district court in this case abused its discretion by making certain presumptions of what the state of the law was with respect to the standard for reviewing that petition. For example, the court basically disregarded any evidence concerning the motivation for the lawsuit and its political nature by saying that, well, the court would not infer bad faith merely because of the relationship between the participants and the other organizations. But that was
under Supreme Court precedents, the fact that a lawsuit may have political overtones is utterly irrelevant. I don't know if you're familiar in the antitrust area with what's called the Knorr-Pennington Doctrine, but people bring lawsuits all the time in order to advance a political agenda. They'll bring lawsuits against the billboard industry to make sure that print media still have an advantage in town. I'm thinking of Omni Outdoor Advertising. I wasn't at all persuaded that the fact that an otherwise well-founded lawsuit that also is serving someone's political agenda is in any way an abusive process.
Well, Your Honor, I mean, this case has some unique circumstances. One is that the participants initially sought to represent a class.
Why is that unique?
Because the class... Well, let me explain. Let me go on and explain. If you're representing a class, you're supposed to be fairly impartially representing the interest of the class. Some of the class members, and indeed the vast majority of the class members, in the putative class members in this case, do not share the political views or motives of the particular participants in this case.
So that's fine. I mean, people bring class actions all the time where a district court quite appropriately denies class certification because either the 23A or the 23B requirements aren't satisfied, which would be the case that you're talking about, since you would fail typicality, among other things.
That's true, Your Honor. But here, I mean, the whole pattern of the litigation where the participants refuse to even disclose the relationship until the last second prior to the class certification motion being decided. And it shows, I mean, to us, that shows an attempt at basically hiding from the fund and from the court the fact that their interests were not aligned necessarily with the entire class. And the quotes that we gave to the court from the participants, that one of the participants themselves, and the communications between them basically amount to saying, we don't, you know, the lawsuit, keep, you know, we're going to put this political pressure on the lawsuit, and we don't really care whether the lawsuit, you know, they want it to succeed, but even if it doesn't, it's serving their purpose by going forward with it.
Well, I'm just saying the standard that the court adopts in Omni Outdoor Advertising, I'm pretty sure it's an opinion by Justice Scalia, is a very high standard for throwing lawsuits out because of political motivations. As long as the lawsuit doesn't fail the test of literally an abusive process, you're not going to see that happening, at least under that standard. And I understand, you know, that you might be frustrated that this was there, but the objective inquiry is whether there was a basis for this suit. And some of the individuals may well have claims for which at least there's a basis. We'll have to decide whether there's grounds for relief. And Hines is out there, which is suggesting that at least the anti-cutback rule was broader than people had thought it was before Hines. You recall what the law was before Hines. So I, you know, the district judge, it seems to me, makes a comment about the good faith of the plaintiffs, but she's not placing undue weight on that standard.
Well, Your Honor, turning to whether the claims were at least had a substantial basis, the court says, well, three of the claims had a substantial basis, and yet under this court's Sinise case, the court says fees can be awarded with respect to claims that had no basis, even if there are claims in the case that had basis. And at this point in the case, I mean, we could see now that almost all of the original claims fell away, and
why isn't that within the discretion of the district judge to decide whether, on balance, fees should be awarded when plaintiffs quickly get some of them out of the case and some of them go further and there's some that seem better founded than others? It sounds like a discretionary call.
It's a discretionary call, Your Honor, if the court actually weighs all of the claims and says, perhaps on balance, the three, you know, had some justification. But here the court said three claims had substantial justification, period. And I would suggest to the court that here, you know, a lot of the claims didn't just go away easily, and that the fact that the fund could get some knocked out doesn't mean that the fund shouldn't be entitled to fees for having to go through the work to do that.
Thank you, Mr.
Thank you,
Frenzel.
Your Honors.
Ms. Thompson.
Thank you, Your Honor. Unless the court has questions about the cross appeal, the attorney fee issue, I will rely on my brief. Okay. I just want to hit a few points here. I think it is a disturbing precedent for a plan to be able to come into court and claim that it can take certain actions against its participants without a plan provision that provides for it. And that's what they are claiming in this case. And they are also claiming that when they put in an amendment which permits them to do that, which was, they said they always could do, that implicates the anti-cutback rule. I am not going to belabor that. I would focus on one other thing that I think Judge Woods hit upon, and that is this, that what has changed here with respect to the rule, and it's in connection with the amendments, it's specifically part of one of the amendments, is that the presumptions and burdens of proof have changed. It is now
There is now a presumption that somebody is in prohibited employment no matter what they're doing until it is proved otherwise, and an entirely formerly discretionary standard, which was exercised only rarely, I would submit, has now become a mandatory one, and that this, too, is a significant additional burden on the receipt of these benefits. Moving to the individual cases, I would like to make one point with respect to this plant and building maintenance question, because I think it illustrates a much broader and much more serious problem, and that is this. Mr. Nelson, who is the director of benefits for the fund, he's been there for years and years and years, admitted that the plant maintenance and building maintenance are used interchangeably and that they are ambiguous without further context to know what they're talking about. Either one could refer to machine repair. Either one could refer to janitorial. So it's not the case that the fund has some longstanding interpretation of the differences between these two words. And in fact, the point of Mr. Rose's case is that they never explain in their decision why it makes a difference. The only reason they changed their mind is because he called his job by a slightly different title. The fact that people got approved in the past and are suddenly being charged with huge overpayments, I think, is indicative, illustrative of the fact that the purpose of the entire rule has changed, and that is going to leave the participants out there who had some understanding of what the rule covered before without any moorings to be able to figure out in their how to run their lives in their retirement what they can and cannot do. And this is further complicated by how the fund interprets or applies the classification requirement. Because suddenly, I would submit to the court, and I know these things are hard to prove, but Teamsters have an understanding of what a job classification is because they've lived all their working lives under collective bargaining agreements. And now all of a sudden, in the context of trying to defend themselves against these allegations that they've been doing something terribly wrong, they are suddenly... they learn that, no, a job classification doesn't mean a driver or shipping and receiving or driver helper. It means on occasion I have to sweep the floor, or on occasion I have to stock a shelf, or on occasion I have to put something on a truck. That's not a job classification. And similar problems with respect to industry.
Tom Snyder, thank you.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Our thanks to both.